Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Conversations with Eastside podcast. Eastside Church is an eclectic community of worshipers on the east side of Atlanta, Georgia. My name is Ed, and I'm a member here at Eastside, and today I've got Tim Lloyd, our lead pastor, and we'll be discussing liturgy and the meaning behind our Sunday worship. Hallowed be thy name. All right, so today we're going to talk a little bit about liturgy and our worship services on Sundays at Eastside. So, Tim, why do we worship? Why do we have a worship service on a Sunday, on a weekend, every week? Well, why do we do this?
Why do we worship? That's a big question. And I think that we could start back in the book of Genesis with the creation poem when we see God, the ancient writers of scripture sort of poetically describing God creating our world in 6 days, and then the seventh day God rests from God's work, not because God was tired probably, but because God was marking out the seventh day as an example for humanity to do the same. And since ancient Judaism, we have seen this pattern of a holy day in our week that we mark to take time to worship the Creator out of gratitude, out of thankfulness, in response to what God has done for us, in a movement of love from humanity to the divine. And that's kind of the meta answer I would offer.
Sure. So our worship services on Sundays are inextricably tied with Sabbath and the idea of God resting and people resting, you know, in ancient Jewish times, so that they could worship, so that they could gather and have a sort of communal moment of worship as a community.
Right. Yeah. The idea is get your work done the first 6 days, and then this seventh day is carved out and set aside for us to have the time to come together as a people. And to, in some form or fashion, we're going to talk about the form and fashion and
right.
the meaning there, come together and offer something back to our Creator.
So, and we talk about liturgy. It's a word that's thrown around a lot. It sounds cool. Invokes a lot of, I think of literally a printed order on a bulletin, things like that. We looked up what liturgy means, and really it's like the work of people in a public way. What has been liturgy and what does it mean for us, when we talk about liturgy in a worship service?
Yeah. A couple years ago, actually, interestingly, the lectionary, which we can talk about that at some point, has the part of the Old Testament readings right now are in the book of Exodus. And there's this story when Moses first goes to Pharaoh to bargain to get the people some freedom. His bargaining is, let my people go out into the wilderness so that they can worship their our people's God, Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And so there's this like sense of which, at the very beginning of the story of liberation, one of the big reasons that God is so angry at Pharaoh is because Pharaoh doesn't give them the opportunity to worship God. And one of the things I always think is interesting when you talk about the idea of the seven-day creation is, if you don't take the seventh day and mark it as a day of rest and of worship, then you just have a six-day work week. And it's kind of eerie, but if you think about it, then it would be 6, 6, 6, 6. On and on, a day devoid of the worship of a week devoid of the worship of God. It would be a week where we always work and we never take time to set that aside. That's sort of one of the interesting parts of the Moses story is that was one of the big reasons that God wanted to liberate God's people and to set them free, was so that they could worship,
right?
Freedom to worship. Which is kind of a cool idea.
And to do it together as a people.
And to do it as a people, yeah. And you were talking about liturgy, this idea of the work of the people. Always, within the Jewish narrative, worship has been this corporate act where mm-hmm. the people would come together and as a gathered community would worship Yahweh, and that the ways that they would worship Yahweh kind of developed throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament, but there was always these sort of defining characteristics. So
right on. Cool. So I think what we're going to do for the balance of our time is to actually go through our order of worship at Eastside on Sundays. And I think it should prove interesting because it's such a rhythm that's almost unconscious. We show up and we kind of go through it, and it feels really natural. And even when you go from one church to another church, there's some form of this a lot of times, you know. I always will get nervous when I'm visiting like an Episcopal church or some other church that's got like a lot of rich tradition and ritual. And then the bulletin is like, you know, thick, like 16 pages, yeah. You know, and you open it up and you're going through and you're like, wow, there's a lot to do here.
Right.
But it always kind of falls back into a pattern or a rhythm that's familiar. But I think that when we dig in, it's there's so much meaning that's behind what we do. It's so intentional. So, you know, let's dig in.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yeah. Ed.
The ancient Jewish people worshipped on Saturday. Sabbath started sundown on Friday and was a 24-hour period that ended at sundown on Saturday. But you just, like you just said, we come together on Sundays. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it seems like it has something to do with the resurrection. That I've heard you preach that before, that the resurrection really... As we look across the Gospel of John and, you know, the seven miraculous signs, you know, the eighth was that resurrection, that new day, that new moment in creation going forward. And so when we think about, you know, the Holy Week, and we think about Jesus being raised on the third day, and that being really the center and the core, beginning with the early church and into perpetuity in the Christian world, we celebrate... We celebrate and worship God and gather in as a community on that in commemoration of that that Resurrection Sunday. So it's sort of like a mini Easter every time we gather.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's especially meaningful for a church who, you know, professes this idea of being central, you know, the central idea of practicing resurrection.
Yeah.
I think that that's crucial.
Cool.
Cool. So let's jump into the order. I think it's fascinating. You know, we'll just for a brief second, I think it's interesting. I'm in the band, or I'll be a liturgist, or I'll do a lot of stuff that gets me to church kind of early, and I'll see you or somebody else with billows of incense coming out of like what looks like something from Harry Potter, this like sphere that's really filling the sanctuary with a certain scent and, you know, like a white billows of smoke. What's the deal with incense? Why do we do that?
The very simple answer is that it is a visual and a olfactory way of representing our prayers rising up to God.
Sure.
And it actually stretches all the way back, I believe, to the book of Leviticus is where they first... encounter incense and talk about actually the formula for the incense that was supposed to be used in worship.
Oh, wow.
And there's a crazy story that we're not going to get into right now, but where they used the wrong incense and some things go poorly. But yeah, so at Eastside, it actually is sort of not normal for a Methodist church to utilize incense. It became one of those pieces when the Protestant Reformation happened that the reformers felt like incense was too similar to the Catholic Church or the Eastern Orthodox. But there's been a resurgence sort of on the other side of, you know, emerging worship communities who are trying to reclaim the idea of engaging all five senses in worship. Mm-hmm. And I've just recently even had people from Eastside say, like, we really miss the Sundays when we arrive and it's not lingering in the air. Because sometimes... we get busy and it doesn't end up getting lit and it doesn't end up filling the sanctuary. And we always try to do it before everybody gets there so that it's not, we know some folks have allergens and it's hard on some people's sinuses. So we try to do it early so it's just a lingering scent. But the idea is that to send the message that somebody has prayed over this sanctuary this morning and they've spread that incense throughout the sanctuary in preparation for our gathering.
That's great.
And it was in ancient Judaism in their worship. It's still to this day in Eastern Orthodox Episcopal worship and Catholic worship. And like I said, some Protestant churches are starting to reclaim it as well.
Shout out to the ancients. Right on.
There you go.
Then we start, for some reason, having a... we have kind of an opening worship, and there's usually an opening prayer. It's kind of an invitation or an invocation, maybe. Tell us like a little bit about that.
Yeah, the invocation is that moment where we're setting the space aside as holy, and I'll make the point to say, God, we make our beginning in your name, Father, Son, and Spirit.
Right.
This idea that our worship gathering, we're entering into the divine community of Father, Son, Spirit of the Trinity. We're being sort of wrapped up into that community in this gathered body. And you know, I'm naming that, and I'm invoking that, and I'm asking, I almost always in some way say, God, may none of us leave this place without having encountered your presence in a special and a unique way and having met you, God. So that's, it's a pretty traditional, stretches across traditions and goes all the way back to the Jewish roots of our faith.
It's great. Yeah, I think probably a lot of people don't realize it. It sounds like you're just kind of opening us in prayer, but we're invoking that presence and, you know, fencing off this time and space as holy. And so then we start singing for some reason. For some reason, a bunch of people get up on stage, a bunch of instruments get fired up, and we sing these songs. Why do we sing? And I think about, you know, other worship services I've been in where we whip out the old hymnal, we check for the little numbers on the side of the stage, and
right.
And the organ gets fired up or whatever it is. You know, for whether it's, you know, a song that came out last year or whether it's a song that was written by Charles Wesley like 150 years ago, 200 years ago, or whether right. It was, you know, something, an ancient song written, you know, 100 centuries ago. Why is singing important in Christian worship?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can go about answering that question. I think one of the more interesting ways to start out the conversation is to name the peculiarity of it. I oftentimes will ask people, can you name other times when groups of humans get together and sing? And they normally say the happy birthday song at a birthday party. national anthem,
right?
And maybe karaoke if it's a song that everybody knows.
Sure.
And beyond that, like a concert where somebody would ask, you know,
the crowd
to join in song. But generally speaking, it's quite rare that humans will come together and all sing the same song at the same time.
So
I think at a very practical level, something beautiful about the moment of singing together as the church is this idea of mutual submission. When you're bringing a choir together, the whole group is submitting to this larger reality, which is the song that we're singing or the ideas that we're conveying. The voices that are to our right or to our left, we're either forgiving them for being off key or, you know, admiring how wonderful they sound or something in between there. But it's this big unified reality that all of us in those moments are experiencing together as a community. And it really gets us this idea that liturgy is the work of the people. It's a collective work that we're doing as a body. It's not something that Tim just comes and sits in a pew and hears some music and hears a sermon and goes home. Tim is coming, sitting next to Sally, who's sitting next to Frank, who's sitting next to Charlie, and we're all doing this as a group all at the same time, in the same spirit, with the same goal and the same end. So there's this very, like, practical reality to singing. If you want to talk about it in terms of historically, you know, there's hymns as far back as, I think, Miriam's song after the parting of the Red Sea, maybe the first one, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
But
there's plenty of ancient songs, ancient psalms, you know, part of the Jewish tradition.
Chanting and singing and, we have a whole book of songs in the Old Testament called the Psalter or the Psalms. Mm. and those have been used in musical worship by our Jewish forefathers and mothers for, you know, centuries and centuries. And the early Christians picked up on this idea of corporate song, and there are hymns in the New Testament. There's one in Colossians. There's another one in the second chapter of the book of Philippians. And then obviously in the book of Revelation, you have these throne room scenes where the angels are singing to the glory of God. And those throne room scenes are found in the Old Testament visions as well.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting because I think, I've played in the band and led sessions of worship, you know, through the course of my life. And I think one of the powerful moments, some of the most powerful moments, are when we're singing some of those ancient songs. We sing, you know, one of these songs every week at Eastside, pretty much almost every week, you know, during communion liturgy around like the Holy, Holy, Holy. And it's, I think, interesting because there's a soundtrack to the universe, and that's what scripture teaches us, right? That angelic beings since the beginning of time to the end of time have been singing of the holiness of God.
Yeah.
And there's this intersection, this kind of tangent, a tangent in the sense of like a line intersecting with a circle, where we are joining in that soundtrack for like an instant, for like a minute, you know, on a Sunday.
We're being swept up, or heaven's being swept down, or some interchange of the two when we're gathering for worship.
Yep.
Like there's a line from an All Sons and Daughters song that says, "When heaven meets earth."
Right.
And I think that for me, you know, that there's something about music and music within the Christian tradition that sort of steps us into an alternate universe for a time as we're gathered.
And boy, I mean, what's funny is to think about a worship service with no music.
Huh. Right, right.
That'd be weird. It'd be a lot of talking, some silence. You know, like just, that'd be kind of whack. Interesting about corporate singing that you mentioned earlier, just kind of like as a phenomenon by itself. I remember there's this podcast I listened to, the Slate Political Gabfest. This guy, David Plotz, he's like the host of the show. And they sometimes have live sessions, like live podcasts, where they go to like a university or somewhere and they get a bunch of people together. They record the session. And he's really into corporate singing. Like for a little while, he was just really into corporate singing. So he'd get everyone together, and after the podcast was over, they would sing like "This Land Is Your Land." Like they'd sing stuff like that, like just songs that everyone knows the words to.
Yeah.
Because he just loves it so much. Hmm. And he's not a Christian guy, I don't think. And, you know, like it's not a worship session, you know, but like just that by itself, something is built into that moment of corporate worship, of corporate singing, I should say. I think worship and song has been, you know, like co-opted into kind of an interchangeable term, which is not totally accurate. But yeah, corporate singing has like there's something to it. And also the phenomenon you're talking about, I was reading recently about how many milliseconds pass between the time when you hear something and you can respond by saying something or banging on an instrument or something. And there's actually a latency. Like, we should all never be able to sing in unison. It's almost impossible. It requires anticipation. Because when you're not playing something the second you hear it, you have to be playing it a little bit before you hear it. So you're always playing a note or singing a song a little bit back in time. Like, it's a strange thing. And yet we do it. And you listen to recordings that are made real time of everybody singing at one time, and everyone is singing at one time. You don't have a bunch of voices like trailing each other and like singing just a little bit after each other. So there's like, it's like kind of this physical miracle that happens when like a bunch of people get together and raise their voice in song.
Yeah. Wow. I've never thought about it that way.
Yeah. But deeply collaborative, like you said.
So then the other really practical thing that corporate singing does is it reinforces what we believe about God, who we believe God to be, what we believe God's calling is on us. So songs like the Prayer of St. Francis that talk about being the hands and feet of Jesus and being instruments of peace. Then you have songs like the Holy, Holy, Holy Lord God Almighty. We're naming who we as a community believe God to be. And whenever I meet with a worship planning team, I always, you know, from time to time we'll remind them, you know, you realize that what we're doing when we pick out songs for worship, we're actually asking everybody in the church to say these things with their mouths out loud. Like a sermon, you might disagree with some things that I say. I'm getting up there and sort of speaking as the pastor, but you can sit there and receive them or disagree with them. But when we're asking everybody to sing all these songs together, that's a big responsibility.
People are generally trying to participate. Yeah.
Right. And we're embodying we're either reinforcing our theology, or I've been to worship services where they'll sing a song that I'll be like, that doesn't make sense with other things you've already said in this service or things that you've said you believed. And so we try really hard at Eastside to not ask people to sing things that are out of sync with our theology and who we are as a community. But we try to reinforce those realities. And it's a
confession of belief. And
can be, yeah.
Absolutely. And saying it together is that much more powerful, I think. Interestingly, and I'm going to point this out as we go through this order of worship, that's one of those things that you really can't do at home by yourself, like just without other people around. You can pump up your, whatever, 104.7 and like try to sing in the car. And that's something, but it's more like, that's more like karaoke or like a personal time with God maybe. But like this corporate singing is a declaration of what we believe together. Right?
Yeah.
And so it's unique to our identity as a community.
And you got at this a little bit ago, but I want to just reiterate it. At Eastside, we do not, there's not a one-to-one correlation between the word worship and the word and the time of song. And that's why when I'm done with my invocation at the beginning, I say, now we're going to enter into a time of worship through song. But there are circles of Christianity that when they say worship, what they really mean is the time of music. But we really feel like and believe that our entire gathered service together, that all of it are different acts of worship.
Yep.
And that realistically, the entirety of our lives are to be offered as acts of worship to God. And that music and collective singing is one way we do that. So that's just a little caveat. But
all right, that's where we'll leave it today for part one of this conversation. Part two is coming at you next time when Tim and I will discuss the other components of our order of Sunday worship, the real meaning behind each one, and why the worship experience has been designed to focus on bringing us together as a community. Until then, thanks for listening and be blessed in your life.